suggests her preoccupation around the idea of recycling myth and history in a uniquely feminine voice. There's no doubt that this new collection will once again show the poignancy and power that is anchored in the authenticity of Carol Ann Duffy's voices. And as Helen Dunmore notes, very few poets ever manage to make their readers feel again and again that strange pang of mingled recognition and excitement that Duffy can evoke. Carol Ann Duffy has proven that poetry can occur in the kitchen, the schoolyard, or street, in the magic of myth, or in the hilarity of everyday life. We are very lucky to have Carol Ann Duffy here with us tonight to read her poetry in her own voice. This is Carol Ann Duffy. Sorry.
Introduction was considerably better than the poetry is going to be, I felt. I was wondering what to read this evening, and I decided that I would be brave and read, for the first part of the reading, some poems that are coming from a new book I'm publishing in the autumn. And some of these poems I haven't ever read in public before, but I thought I would do that, and then maybe take refuge after that in earlier work. So I'll read a few poems from Feminine Gospels. I think the thinking I have in Feminine Gospels is women's experience related as tall tales, but those tall tales put across as though they were gospel truth, and with quite a lot of use of the body in them. But I'll try some out on you. And the very first poem in the collection is called The Long Queen, which sort of sets the scene of the book. The Long Queen couldn't die. Young when she bowed her head for the cold weight of the crown, she looked at the second son of the Earl, the foreign prince, the heir to the Duke, the Lord, the Baronet, the Count, then taken time for a husband. Long live the Queen. What was she queen of? Women, girls, spinsters and hags, matrons, wet nurses, witches, widows, wives, mothers of all these. Her word of law was in their bones, in the graft of their hands, in the wild kicks of their dancing. No girl born who wasn't the Long Queen's always child. Unseen, she ruled and reigned. Some said in a castle. Some said in a tower in the dark heart of a wood. Some said out and about in rags, disguised, sorting the bad from the good. She sent her explorers away in their creaking ships and was queen of more, of all the dead when they lived, if they did so female. All hail to the queen. What were her laws? Childhood. Whether a girl awoke from the bad dream of the worst, or another swooned into memory, bereaved, bereft, or a third one wrote it all down like a charge sheet, or the fourth never left, scouring the markets and shops for her old books and toys. No girl growing who wasn't the apple of the Long Queen's eye. Blood. Proof in the Long Queen's colour, royal red of intent. The pain when a girl first bled to be insignificant, no cause for complaint. And this to be monthly, linked to the moon, till middle age when the law would change. Tears. Salt pearls, bright jewels for the Long Queen's fingers to weigh as she counted their sorrow. Childbirth. Most to lie on the birthing beds, pushed till the room screamed scarlet and children bawled and slithered into their arms, sore flowers. Some to be godmother, aunt, teacher, teller of tall tales, but all who were there to swear that the pain was worth it. No mother bore daughter not named to honour the queen. And her pleasures were stories, true or false, that came in the evening, drifting up on the air to the high window she watched from. Confession or gossip, scandal or anecdote, secrets, her ear tuned to the light music of girls, the drums of women, the faint strings of the old, long queen, all her possessions for a moment of time. The diet. The diet worked like a dream. No sugar, salt, dairy, fat, protein, starch, or alcohol. By the end of week one, she was half a stone shy of 10 and shrinking, skipping breakfast, lunch, dinner, thinner. A fortnight in, she was 8 stone. By the end of a month, she was skin and bone. She starved on, stayed in, stared in the mirror, svelter, slimmer. The last apple aged in the fruit bowl, untouched. The skimmed milk soured in the fridge, unsupped. Her skeleton preened under its tight flesh dress. She was all eyes, all cheekbones, had guns for hips, not a stitch in the wardrobe fitted. What passed her lips? Air? Water? She was anorexia's true daughter, a slip of a girl, a shadow dwindling away. One day, the width of a stick, she started to grow smaller, child-sized, doll-sized, the height of a thimble. She sat at her open window and the wind blew her away. Seed small, she was out and about looking for home. An empty beer bottle rolled in the gutter. She crawled in, got drunk on the dregs, started to sing, down, out, nobody's love. Tiny others joined in. They raved all night. She woke alone, head splitting, mouth dry, hungry and cold, and made for the light. She found she could fly on the wind, could breathe if it rained underwater. That night, she went to a hotel bar that she knew and floated into the barman's eye. She slept for hours, left at dawn in a blink, in a wink, drifted away on a breeze, minute. She could suit herself from here on in, go where she pleased. She stayed near people, lay in the tent of a nostril like a germ, dwelled in the caves of an ear. She lived in a tear, swam clear, moved south to a mouth kipped in the chap of a lip. She loved flesh and blood, wallowed in mud under fingernails, dossed in a fold of fat on a waist. But when she squatted the tip of a tongue, she was gulped, swallowed, sent down the hatch in a river of wine, bottoms up, cheers, fetched up in a stomach just before lunch. She crouched in the lining, hearing the avalanche munch of food. Then it was carrots, peas, courgettes, potatoes, gravy and meat. Then it was sweet. Then it was Stilton, Roquefort, Vice Lacacasa, Gex. It was smoked salmon with scrambled eggs, hot boiled ham, plum flan, frog's legs. She knew where she was all right. Clambered onto the greasy breast of a goose, open wide, then chomped and chewed and gorged inside the fat woman now, trying to get out. The woman who shopped. The woman who shopped went out with a silver shilling, willing to buy, bought an apple, red as first love's heart, bright as her eye, had plenty of change, purchased a hat with a brim, walked with a suitor under its shadow, ditched him. Saved up a pound, a fiver, a tenner, haggled the price of a dancing dress down to a snip, spent the remainder on shoes, danced from the house down the street, tapped to the centre of town where the sales had commenced, applied for a job for the wage and the bonus, blew it on clothes. wanted a wedding dress, groom, married him, wanted a honeymoon, went on one, looked at the gold of her ring as it flashed in the sun, flew away home to furnish each room of the house, shuffle his plastic with hers, deal them out in the shops for cutlery, crockery, dishwashers, bed linen, TV sets, three-piece suites, stereos, microwaves, telephones, curtains and mirrors and rugs, shrugged at the cost, then fixed up alone, filled up the spare room with boxes of merchandise, unopened cartons, overstuffed bags, went on the internet, shopped in America, all over Europe, tapping her credit card's numbers all night, ordering swimming pools, caravans, saunas. When they arrived, stacked up on the lawn, she fled, took to the streets, where the lights from the shops ran like paint in the rain, and pressed her face to the pain of the biggest and best. The happy shoppers were fingering silk, holding cashmere close to their cheeks, dancing with fur. She slept there, curled in the doorway, six shopping bags at her feet. Stone cold when she woke, she was stone, was concrete and glass, her eyes windows squinting back at the night, her brow a domed roof, her thoughts neon, flashing on and off, vague in the daylight. She seemed to be kneeling or squatting, her shoulders broad and hunched, her hands huge and part of the pavement. She looked down. Her skirts were glass doors opening and closing. Her stockings were moving stairs. Her shoes were lifts going up, going down. First floor for perfumery and cosmetics, ladies' accessories, lingerie, fine jewels and watches. Second for homewares, furniture, travel goods, luggage. Third floor for menswear, shaving gear, shoes. Fourth floor for Blux, Toyland, children's wear, sports. Fifth floor for home entertainment, pianos, musical instruments, beauty and hair. Her ribs were carpeted red. Her lungs glittered with chandeliers over the singing tills. Her gut was the food hole, hung with fat pink hams, crammed with cheeses, fruits, wines, truffles, and caviars. She loved her own smell, sweat and Chanel, loved the crowds jostling and thronging her bones, loved the credit cards swiping themselves in her blood. Her breath was gift wrapping, the whisper of tissue and string. She loved the changing rooms of her heart, the rooftop restaurant in her eyes, the dark basement under the lower ground floor where juggernauts growled, unloading their heavy crates. The sky was unwrapping itself, ripping itself into snow. She would have a sale, and crowds would queue overnight at her cunt, desperate for bargains. Light blazed from her now. Birds shrieked and voided themselves in her stone hair. Nothing like the sails, I always think. Next poem's called Tall. Then, like a christening gift or a wish arriving later in life, the woman had height, grew tall, was taller daily. Day one saw her rising at 8 foot, bigger than any man. She knelt in the shower as if she were praying for rain. Her clothes would be curtains and eiderdowns, towels and rugs. Out, eye high with street lamps, she took a walk downtown. Somebody whooped. She stooped, hands on both knees, and stared at his scared face, the red heart tattooed on his small chest. He turned and fled like a boy. On. A tree dangled an apple at bite height. She bit it. A traffic light stuttered on red, went out. She lit it. Personal birds sang on her ear. She whistled. Further. Taller as she went, she glanced into upper windows in passing. Saw lovers in the rented rooms over shops. Saw an old man long dead in a chair. Paused there, her breath on the glass. She bowed herself into a bar, ordered a stiff drink. It came on the rocks on the house. A drunk passed out or fainted. She pulled up a stool, sat at the bar with her knees under her chin, called for another gin, a large one. She saw a face, high in the mirror behind the top shelf. Herself. Day two, she was hungover, all over, her head in her hands in the hall, her feet at the top of the stairs, more tall. She needed a turret. Found one, day three, on the edge of town, moved in. Her head in the clouds now, showering in rain. But pilgrims came. Small women with questions and worries, men on stilts. She was 30 foot, growing, could see for miles. So day six, she upped sticks, horizon bound in 7-league boots. Local crowds swarmed round her feet, chanting. She cured no one, grew. The moon came closer at night, its scarred face an old mirror. She slept outdoors, stretched across empty fields or sand. The stars trembled. Taller was colder, a loner, no wiser. What could she see up there? She told them what kind of weather was heading their way. Dust storms over the pyramids, hurricanes over the USA, floods in the UK. But by now the people were tiny and far away. And she was taller than Jupiter, Saturn, the Milky Way. Nothing to see. She looked back and howled. She stooped low and caught their souls in her hands as they fell from the burning towers. Next poem is Loud. The news had often made her shout, but one day her voice ripped out of her throat like a firework with a terrible sulphurous crack that made her jump, a flash of light in the dark. Now she was loud. Before, she'd been easily led, one of the crowd, joined in with the national whoop for the winning goal, the booze for the bent MP, the cheer for the royal kiss on the balcony. Not anymore. Now she could roar. She practiced alone at home, found she could call abroad without using the phone, could sing like an orchestra in the bath, could yawn like thunder watching TV. She switched to the news. It was all about Muslims, Christians, Jews. Then her scream was a huge bird that flew her away into the dark, each vast wing a shriek awful to hear. The beak, the sickening hiss of a thrown spear. She stayed up there all night in the wind and rain, wailing, uttering, lightning. Down, she was pure sound, rumbling like an avalanche. She bit radios, swallowed them, gargled their news, saw the words well, ran into the church and sprayed the congregation with bullets no one has claimed, gibberish, crap in the cave of her mouth. Her voice stomped through the city, shouting the odds, shaking the bells awake in their towers. She yelled through the countryside, swelling the rivers, felling the woods. She put out to sea, screeching and bellowing, spewing brine. She bawled at the moon, and it span away into space. She hollered into the dark, where fighter planes buzzed at her face. She howled till every noise in the world sang in the spit on the tip of her tongue, the shriek of a bomb, the bang of a gun, the prayers of the priest, the pad of the feet in the mosque, the casual rip of the post, the mother's sobs, the thump of the drop, the president's cough, the screams of the children cowering under their pews, loud, loud, louder, the news. And just the last poem from these new ones for the moment. A slight change of of mood here is a poem called Sub, which, as you know, can be a football term if you David Beckham, and also can mean underneath, below. And this sort of history poem for women, really. Sub. I came on in extra time in 66. My breasts bandaged beneath my number 13 shirt, and put it in off the head, the back of the heel, the left foot from 30 yards out, hat trick. If they'd thought the game was all over, it was now. I felt secure as I danced in my dazzling whites with the cup, tampon, but skipped the team bath with the lads, sipped my champagne in the solitary shower, as the blood and soap suds mingled to pink. They sang my name on the other side of the steam. Came on too in the final gasps of the Grand Slam clincher, scooped up the ball from the back of the scrum, ran like the wind, bandaged again, time of the month likewise, wiggled, weaved, waved at the crowd, slipped like soap through muddy hands, like that. Slid between legs, nursing the precious egg of the ball, then flung myself like breaking surf over the line for the winning try, converted it, was carried shoulder high by the boys as the whistle blew. They roared my name through mouthfuls of broken teeth. Ringo had flew when the Fab Four toured down under. Minus a drummer, the gig was a bummer till I stepped in, digits ringed, sticked, skinned in a beetle skirt, mop-topped fringe, to wink at Paul, quip with John, climb on the drums, clever-fingered and thumbed, give it four to the bar, give it yeah, yeah, yeah. The screams were lava, hot to sex, and every seat in the house was wet. We sang, help. Day tripper, money, this boy, girl, she loves you, John, Paul, George, and moi. It was one small step for a man for Neil to stand on the moon, a small hop for me to stand in for Buzz, bouncing my moon suit over the dust, waving a flag. I knelt, scooped out a hole in the powdery ground, and buried a box with a bottle of malt, chocolates, Emily Dickinson's poems. Ground control barked down the line. Houston, we don't have a problem, I said. It comforts me now, the thought of them there, when I look at the moon. Quietly there on the moon, the things that I like. And when Beefy fell sick in the final test, I stepped up, two of his boxes over my chest, and hooked a four from the first of Lily's balls. He bowled so fast you could hear his fingers click as he spun off the seam. I lolled at the crease, 3 months gone, and looped and hooped them about like a dream. Googlies, bosies, Chinamen, zooters, balls that dipped, flipped, nipped, whipped at the wicket like bombs. I felt the first kick of my child whacked a century into the crowd. Motherhood, then, kept me busy at home till my girl started school. Not match fit, I was talked into management when Taylor went, caretaker role. Jack that in after the World Cup win, Beckham free kick in extra time, and agreed on a whim to slim to the weight of a boy, ride the winner at Aintree, Bobby Joe 99, when the jockey dislocated his neck. After that, I pulled right back, signed up to write a book of my life and times, though I did play guitar for the band in LA when Bob gave me the call. And when I look back, or my grandchildren ask me what it was like to put Muhammad Ali on the deck when Cooper was scratched from the scrap, or stand in for Graham Hill to be Formula One Grand Champ in the fastest recorded speed, or to dress up as Borg in bandana and wig and steal the fifth set at Wimbledon from under. You cannot be serious, McEnroe's nose. Or to kneel, best of all, first woman there on the moon, and gaze at the beautiful faraway earth. What I think to myself is this. So I'm going to read now some poems from... Thank you. The book that precedes this new one, The World's Wife. obviously, the poem I just read comes out of that this kind of work. So this is Mrs. Midas. And Mrs. Midas is cooking in the kitchen. She's just reached that point of her cooking when the vegetables are steaming, and she's pours herself a glass of wine. And she happens to look down the garden, and she sees Midas at the end of the garden, up to no good. And you'll all remember that Midas was given a wish by the gods and asked that everything he touched turn to gold. Mrs. Midas. It was late September. I'd just poured a glass of wine, begun to unwind while the vegetables cooked. The kitchen filled with the smell of itself, relaxed, its steamy breath gently blanching the windows. So I opened one, then with my fingers wiped the other's glass like a brow. He was standing under the pear tree, snapping a twig. Now, the garden was long and the visibility poor, the way the dark of the ground seems to drink the light of the sky. But that twig in his hand was gold. And then he plucked a pear from a branch. We grew fondant d'automne. And it sat in his palm like a light bulb, on. I thought to myself, is he putting fairy lights in that tree? He came into the house. The doorknobs gleamed. He drew the blinds. You know the mind. I thought of the field of the cloth of gold and of Miss MacReady. He sat in that chair like a king on a burnished throne. The look on his face was strange, wild, vain. I said, what in the name of God is going on? He started to laugh. I served up the meal. For starters, corn on the cob. Within seconds, he was spitting out the teeth of the rich. He toyed with his spoon, then mine, then with the knives, the forks. He asked, where was the wine? I poured with a shaking hand, a fragrant bone-dry white from Italy, then watched as he picked up the glass, goblet, golden chalice, drank. It was then that I started to scream. He sank to his knees. After we'd both calmed down, I finished the wine on my own, hearing him out. I made him sit on the other side of the room, keep his hands to himself. I locked the cat in the cellar. I moved the phone. The toilet I didn't mind. I couldn't believe my ears, how he'd had a wish. Look, we all have wishes. Granted. But who has wishes granted? Him. Do you know about gold? It feeds no one. Aurum, soft, untarnishable, slakes no thirst. He tried to light a cigarette. I gazed, entranced, as the blue flame played on its luteous stem. At least, I said, you'll be able to give up smoking for good. Separate beds. In fact, I put a chair against my door, near petrified. He was below, turning the spare room into the tomb of Tutankhamun. You see, we were passionate then, in those halcyon days, unwrapping each other rapidly like presents, fast food. But now I feared his honeyed embrace, the kiss that would turn my lips to a work of art, and who, when it comes to the crunch, can live with a heart of gold. That night, I dreamt I bore his child, its perfect oar limbs, its little tongue like a precious latch, its amber eyes holding their pupils like flies. My dream milk burned in my breasts. I woke to the streaming sun. So he had to move out. We'd a caravan in the wilds, in a glade of its own. I drove him up under cover of dark. He sat in the back. And then I came home, the woman who married the fool who wished for gold. At first I visited, odd times, parking the car a good way off, then walking. You knew you were getting close, golden trout on the grass. One day, a hare hung from a larch, a beautiful lemon mistake, and then his footprint glistening next to the river's path. He was thin, delirious, hearing, he said, the music of Pan from the woods. Listen, that was the last straw. What gets me now is not the idiocy or greed, but lack of thought for me. Pure selfishness. I saw the contents of the house and came down here. I think of him in certain lights. Dawn, late afternoon, and once a bowl of apples stopped me dead. I miss most, even now, his hand, his warm hand on my skin, his touch. And another story from Ovid, from Greek myth, is Mrs. Tiresias. And Tiresias, you'll remember, lived as both a man and a woman. He was a middle-aged man, and he went out walking in the woods one day, and he encountered snakes, two snakes attempting to couple, and he began to beat them with his walking stick, as you would. And the Greek gods were looking down on this little wood, and they were very angry with Tiresias for being unkind to the snakes in this way, and they punished Tiresias by turning him into a woman for 7 years. You may well query the verb. And at the end of 7 years, he could become a man again. So this is that part of the Tiresias myth told from the point of view of his wife. Now, if you see the poem on the page, you'll note that its title is From Mrs. Tiresias. I should explain this, because it does irritate people. I read the poem in manuscript form, much as I read poems in manuscript form this evening, and after the reading, I was accosted by an academic from this very university, who said, I did know, didn't I, that my poem didn't cover all of the Tiresias myth. There were bits missing. So when I came to publish it, I've called it From Mrs. Tiresias, as though to suggest the poem's an extract from a longer, more knowledgeable work. Which it ain't. And rather satisfyingly, I get the odd email from other academics saying, where can they put their hands on the complete? So it's a good tip to the students here to write more than you actually do as well. All I know is this. He went out for his walk, a man, and came home female. Out the back gate with his stick, the dog, wearing his gardening kecks, an open-necked shirt, and a jacket in Harris tweed I'd patched at the elbows myself, whistling. He liked to hear the first cuckoo of spring, then write to the Times. I'd usually heard it days before him, but I never let on. I'd heard one that morning while he was asleep, just as I heard, at about 6 p.m., a faint sneer of thunder up in the woods, and felt a sudden heat at the back of my knees. He was late getting back. I was brushing my hair at the mirror and running a bath when a face swam into view next to my own. The eyes were the same, but in the shocking V of the shirt were breasts. When he uttered my name in his woman's voice, I passed out. Life has to go on. I put it about that he was a twin, and this was his sister come down to live, while he himself was working abroad. And at first I tried to be kind, blow-drying his hair till he learnt to do it himself, lending him clothes till he started to shop for his own, sisterly, holding his soft new shape in my arms all night. Then he started his period. 1 week in bed. Two doctors in. Three painkillers 4 times a day. And later, a letter to the powers that be demanding full paid menstrual leave 12 weeks per year. I see him still, his selfish, pale face peering at the moon through the bathroom window. "The curse," he said, "the curse. Don't kiss me in public," he snapped the next day. "I don't want folk getting the wrong idea." It got worse. After the split, I would glimpse him out and about, entering glitzy restaurants on the arms of powerful men, though I knew for sure there'd be nothing of that going on if he had his way, or on TV telling the women out there how, as a woman himself, he knew how we felt, his flirt smile. The one thing he never got right was the voice. A cling peach slithering out from its tin. I gritted my teeth. "And this is my lover," I said, "the one time we met at a glittering ball under the lights among tinkling glass and watched the way he stared at her violet eyes, at the blaze of her skin, the slow caress of her hand on the back of my neck, and saw him picture her bite at the fruit of my lips, and hear my red, wet cry in the night as she shook his hand, saying, 'How do you do?' And I noticed then his hands, her hands, the clash of their sparkling rings and their painted nails." Read a shorter one now. This is Mrs. Aesop. I was taught in junior school at Fowlte almost daily on the fables of Aesop. And although I was the kind of child, like most kids, I like stories featuring animals, I was often oddly disappointed by Aesop. I think probably because of those morals tacked on the end. And he has managed, although there wouldn't have been clichés in his time, to deposit a huge amount of cliché here and there in the English language. So I wanted to look at Aesop for the purposes of this book, and I tried to find out a bit about him in his time, and I could only find out that he was very small, even for those days, and this seemed to fit. And reread not all, but many of the fables, and everything in the poem is from Aesop. As I was finishing the poem, there was renewed debate about the Bobbitt case, which some here might recall, and this seemed to me to be a kind of Aesop image, so this gave me my ending, or lack of ending, as it were. Mrs. Aesop. By Christ, he could bore for purgatory. He was small, didn't prepossess, so he tried to impress. "Dead men, Mrs. Aesop," he'd say, "tell no tales." Well, let me tell you now that that bird in his hand shat on his sleeve. Never mind the two worth less in the bush. Tedious. Going out was worst. He'd stand at our gate, look, then leap. Scour the hedgerows for a shy mouse, the fields for a sly fox, the sky for one particular swallow that couldn't make a summer. The jackdaw, according to him, envied the eagle. Donkeys would, on the whole, prefer to be lions. On one appalling evening stroll, we passed an old hare snoozing in a ditch. He stopped and made a note. And then, about a mile further on, a tortoise, somebody's pet, creeping slow as marriage up the road. Slow but certain, Mrs. Aesop wins the race. Asshole. What race? What sour grapes? What silk purse, sow's-eared dog in a manger? What big fish? Some days I could barely keep awake as the story droned on towards the moral of itself. Action, Mrs. A, speaks louder than words, and that's another thing. The sex was diabolical. I gave him a fable one night about a little cock that wouldn't crow. A razor-sharp axe with a heart blacker than that pot that called the kettle. "I'll cut off your tail, all right," I said, "to save my face." That shut him up. I laughed last, longest. Very cheap one, I know. But you like it, huh? I'm just going to change the order of the poems. No. This is Mrs. Faust. Again, a great story that we'll all know. And Mrs. Faust met Faust when they were at university. Again, oddly enough, it was this one. And after an up and down relationship, they got married, and here she is recounting their life. And you'll remember that Faust's pact with the devil was for 28 years of unimaginable wealth, power, the ability to time travel, to do magic, to have everything he wanted. But at the end of those years, Mephistopheles arrived to take his soul. Mrs. Faust. First things first, I married Faust. We met as students, shacked up, split up, made up, hitched up, got a mortgage on a house, flourished academically, BA, MA, PhD, no kids, two towelled bathrobes, hers, his. We worked, we saved, we moved again. Fast cars, a boat with sails, a second home in Wales. The latest toys, computers, mobile phones, prospered, moved again. Fast's face was clever, greedy, slightly mad. I was as bad. I grew to love the lifestyle, not the life. He grew to love the kudos, not the wife. He went to whores. I felt not jealousy, but chronic irritation. I went to yoga, tai chi, feng shui, therapy, colonic irrigation. And Faust would boast at dinner parties of the cost of doing deals out east, then take his lust to Soho in a cab, to say the least, to lay the ghost, get lost, meet panthers, feast. He wanted more. I came home late one winter's evening, hadn't eaten. Faust was upstairs in his study in a meeting. I smelt cigar smoke, hellish, oddly sexy, not allowed. I heard Faust and the other laugh aloud. Next thing, the world, as Faust said, spread its legs. First politics, safe seat, MP, right hon, KG. Then banks, offshore, abroad. And business, vice chairman, chairman, owner, lord. Enough? Encore. Faust was cardinal, pope, knew more than God. flew faster than the speed of sound around the globe, lunched, walked on the moon, golfed, holed in one, lit a fat Havana on the sun. Then back to hunch, invested in smart bombs, in harms, Faust dealt in arms, Faust got in deep, got out, bought farms, cloned sheep, Faust surfed the internet for like-minded Bo Peep. As for me, I went my own sweet way, saw Rome in a day, spun gold from hay, had a facelift, had my breasts enlarged, my buttocks tightened, went to China, Thailand, Africa, returned, enlightened, turned 40, celibate, teetotal, vegan, Buddhist, 41, went blonde, redhead, brunette, went native, ape, berserk, bananas, went on the run, alone, went home. Faust was in. "A word," he said. "I spent the night being pleasured by a virtual Helen of Troy. Face that launched 1,000 ships, I kissed its lips. Thing is, I've made a pact with Mephistopheles, the devil's boy. He's on his way to take away what's owed, reap what I sowed. For all these years of gagging for it, going for it, rolling in it, I've sold my soul." At this, I heard a serpent hiss, tasted evil, knew its smell. A scaly devil hands poked up right through the terracotta Tuscan tiles at Faust's bare feet and dragged him, oddly smirking, there and then, straight down to hell. Oh well. Faust Will left everything, the yacht, the several homes, the Learjet, the helipad, the loot, etc., the lot, to me. C'est la vie? When I got ill, it hurt like hell. I bought a kidney with my credit card. Then I got well. I keep Faust's secret still. The clever, cunning, callous bastard didn't have a soul to sell. This is Pygmalion's Bride, returning again to myth. And I think many, many writers, better writers than I have used Pygmalion's story. The original story had Pygmalion as a man who was very unhappy with the behavior of the women in his hometown. So he went back to his house and he carved his ideal woman as a statue and would stay in with the statue of an evening talking to her. But then, as such a man would, he fell in love with the statue and went before the gods and begged that the statue be given life. And as the gods in these stories always seem to grant the men's wishes, that the statue came to life. And they had a night together which resulted in a child, and then Pygmalion's wife fades again from the narrative. So here is Pygmalion's bride telling you her side of the story. Cold I was, like snow, like ivory. I thought, he will not touch me, but he did. He kissed my stone cool lips. I lay still as though I died. He stayed. He thumbed my marbled eyes. He spoke, blunt endearments, what he'd do and how. His words were terrible. My ears were sculpture, stone deaf, shells. I heard the sea. I drowned him out. I heard him shout. He brought me presents, polished pebbles, little bells. I didn't blink, was dumb. He brought me pearls and necklaces and rings. He called them girly things. He ran his clammy hands along my limbs. I didn't shrink, played statue, dumb. He let his fingers sink into my flesh. He squeezed, he pressed. I would not bruise. He looked for marks, for purple hearts, for inky stars, for smudgy clues. His nails were claws. I showed no scratch, no scrape, no scar. He propped me up on pillows, jawed all night. My heart was ice, was glass. His voice was gravel, hoarse. He talked white, black. So I changed tack, grew warm like candle wax, kissed back, was soft, was pliable, began to moan, got hot, got wild, arched, coiled, writhed, begged for his child, and at the climax screamed my head off, all an act, and haven't seen him since. Simple as that. I'm going to read four more poems, and then there's a bookstore area outside, so if anyone would like to come and have a book signed or ask any questions or chat, I'd be more than happy to have a glass of wine with people. So four more. Here's Salome. As you can probably tell by looking at me, I went to a convent as a schoolgirl. And Salome is one of my favourite characters from the New Testament. I was always disappointed that the nuns didn't tell us more about her, her dance and her grisly reward for her dance. So here she is waking up after a very heavy Saturday night. She lives a rather decadent life and has a maid who helps her out. Salome. I'd done it before, and doubtless I'll do it again sooner or later. Woke up with a head on the pillow beside me. Whose? What did it matter? Good looking, of course, dark hair rather matted, the reddish beard several shades lighter, with very deep lines round the eyes, from pain, I'd guess. Maybe laughter, and a beautiful crimson mouth that obviously knew how to flatter, which I kissed, colder than pewter. Strange. What was his name? Peter? Simon? Andrew? John? I knew I'd feel better for tea, dry toast, no butter, so rang for the maid, and, indeed, her innocent clatter of cups and plates, her clearing of clutter, her regional patter, were just what I needed, hungover and wrecked as I was from a night on the batter. Never again. I needed to clean up my act, get fitter, cut out the booze and the fags and the sex, yes, and as for the latter, it was time to turf out the blighter, the beater or biter, who'd come like a lamb to the slaughter, to Salome's bed. In the mirror, I saw my eyes glitter. I flung back the sticky red sheets. And there, like I said, and ain't life a bitch, was his head on a platter. I rather like that one because it's all provided by the Bible. I'm just going to read a poem that fits in with that, but from an earlier book. And it's a poem that derives from a painting by the great surrealist Max Ernst. And again, the religious imagery in it amused me. It's called The Virgin Mary Spanking the Baby Jesus, the painting by Max Ernst. And in the middle of the canvas is the mother, and the infant is the wrong way round on her lap, and she's spanking him. And during this chastisement, his little halo has fallen off and rolled under a window where there are three men watching. So the poem's written from the point of view of the men watching through the window. And if any of you have young children in your lives, you might imagine what it would really have been like to have been this boy's mother. The virgin punishing the infant. He spoke early, not the goo, goo, goo of infancy, but I am God. Joseph kept away, carving himself a silent Pinocchio out in the woodshed. He said he was a simple man, hadn't dreamed of this. She grew anxious in that second year, would stare at stars saying, "Gabriel? Gabriel? Your guess." The village gossiped in the sun. The child was solitary. His wide and solemn eyes could fill your head. After he walked, our normal children crawled. Our wives were first resentful, then superior. Mary's child would bring her sorrow. Better far to have a son who gurgled nonsense at your breast. "Goo-goo, goo-goo, but I am God." We heard him through the window, heard the smacks which made us peep. What we saw was commonplace enough, but afterwards we wondered why the infant did not cry and why the mother did. And I'm going to finish with two poems from a book called Meantime. I know there are some young students in who are studying some of the poems from that book, so I thought I'd read a couple for them. One longish one called The Biographer. And The Biographer came out of my interest in the popularity of the form of biography in our time. It's best-selling, fascinating quality, I suppose. I was curious about this. And the poem is in the voice of a fictional biographer, a man made up entirely by myself, who's just finished his biography of an equally fictional writer, 19th century writer, again, who doesn't exist, but would be a kind of Dickens character, I suppose. And the poem is thinking about the idea of time, how we can cross time, and also truth and lies. The Biographer. "Because you are dead, I stand at your desk, my fingers caressing the grooves in the wood your initials made. And I manage a quote, echo one of your lines in the small blue room, where an early daguerreotype shows you excitedly staring out from behind your face, the thing that made you yourself still visibly there, like a hood and a cloak of light. The first four words that I write are your name. I'm a passionate man with a big advance, who's loved your work since he was a boy. But the night I slept alone in your bed, the end of a fire going out in the grate, I came awake, certain, had we ever met, you wouldn't have wanted me or needed me, would barely have noticed me at all. Guilt and rage hardened me then, and later I felt your dislike chilling the air as I drifted away, your wallpaper green and crimson and gold. How close can I get to the sound of your voice, which Emma Elizabeth Hibbert described, lively, eager, and lightly pitched, with none of the later bitter edge, Cockney a little. In London town, the faces you wrote leer and gape and plead at my feet. Once, high on Hungerford Bridge, a stew and tangle of rags sniffed by a dog stood, spoke, spat at the shadow I cast, at the meagre shadow I cast in my time. I heard the faraway bells of St. Paul's as I ran. Maestro, monster, mummy's boy, my main man, I write you and write you for 5 hard years. I have an affair with a thespian girl you would have approved. Then I snivel home to my wife, her poems and jam, her forgiveness, her violent love. And this is a life. I print it out. In all of your mirrors, my face, with its smallish, its quizzical eyes, its cheekbones, its sexy jaw, its talentless dust jacket smile. And I'll finish with a sort of formal sonnet, which is trying to assemble a prayer from secular imagery for those of us who don't have a religious belief, who don't have prayers. Prayer. Some days, although we cannot pray, a prayer utters itself, so a woman will lift her head from the sieve of her hands and stare at the minims sung by a tree, a sudden gift. Some nights, although we are faithless, the truth enters our hearts, that small familiar pain. Then a man will stand stock still, hearing his youth in the distant Latin chanting of a train. Pray for us now. Grade one piano scales, console the lodger looking out across a Midlands town. Then dusk, and someone calls a child's name as though they named their loss. Darkness outside. Inside, the radio's prayer. Rockall, Malin, Dogger, Finisterre. Thank you very much.
I'd just like to thank Carol again for that great reading. And I'd like to point out that I think that reading was particularly good because although we're in this unusually large space for a reading, it felt particularly intimate.
Thank you very much.
That's all right.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to remind you that collections of Carol Ann's poetry are on sale outside the auditorium, and if you show your ticket you can get a 10% discount. But before you all rush out there to buy your books, we're not going to end with me, we're going to end with Carol reading a final poem.
Okay. I just asked to read one last poem and close the evening on that way. So I would go back to The World's Wife, and I took the liberty for this book of pinching an extract from the diary of Mrs. Darwin, which I'd like to read now. I'm sure you'll all be familiar with the theory of evolution here in Warwick. Mrs. Darwin. 7th of April, 1852, went to the zoo. I said to him, "Something about that chimpanzee over there reminds me of you."